Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather here right at the studios of KHOI Community Radio, in the heart of downtown Ames, in the middle of Iowa, in the middle of it all. We are grateful to KHOI for their support. The Donald in the Kitchen has been on the air for a while. We've been in your ears since 2015, believe it or not. And we talk about ingredients here. We like to talk about cooking. We like to talk about healthy food. Food, healthy bodies, and food from the healthy earth. We are going to talk about ingredients today. We're going to be looking at what goes into the soil, what goes into farms to feed us all, what ingredients grow into the growing of our food. Is it good things? Is it not so good things? Today, on the Donald in the Kitchen, we welcome Amber Anderson.
Yes, Amber is an ISU assistant teaching professor in the agronomy department in soil science. She is also the collegiate soil judging coach. It's a thing. Welcome, Amber.
Thanks for having me.
What is soil judging?
Ooh, soil judging is where I work with a bunch of college students who are learning about soil properties, and we go visit a variety of different locations. We pick a different location every semester, have a bunch of soil pits dug so we can see to, say, 5 feet, look at all the different properties that exist, the different layers as you go down, see what it might be best for, what it might be functioning poorly for. And just like animals have a classification system, soils do too. So we classify out the soils, and then on the last day, we compete against other schools that have also looked at these soils in the area and see who can get closest to the official description of the professional soil scientists in the area.
Oh, that sounds like kind of a fun class, actually.
Well, it's one of those dig a big hole things. I like that.
Yes. So, it's amazing what you see once you look below the surface. There's all kinds of things that change underneath.
So does that give you an overview of some of our erosion issues?
Oh, most definitely. Sometimes you can find a dark layer 3, 4, 5 feet down in the soil, especially at the bottom of the hill when we're coming off a steep area.
Uh-huh.
And that was the original surface. So 200 years ago, that may have been on the soil surface. And we've had erosion and then the deposition that we see there on top of it. In some places, we find that naturally on floodplains, where a dark layer represents a time it was stable, and then we have different sorts of sediments for a flood, and then the conditions change, and we have a different set of material there. And then at the top of the hill, we might see that we have a sea horizon parent material, the stuff that was originally deposited by, say, the glacier, almost at the surface. So instead of having the nice, thick, dark, a horizon-rich organic matter layer that we would expect to find across much of the state, it's been redistributed. So sometimes we find a really thick one, sometimes we find thinner ones than we would hope, and soil judging lets me see a bigger picture and try to figure out what happened to that soil, what's its story.
So this is a bit of geology, basically, isn't it?
Maybe. It's a combination of things. We're observing properties and then trying to figure out, work backwards from what we know about the soil forming factors, the landscape, the parent materials, the vegetation, how much time it's had to change, and figure out if we can basically work that backwards. Every soil is a little bit of a puzzle to me. How did that get there? Why does it look like it does today?
So when you're on the farm where you've dug the hole and you've done all this examining, what kind of takeaways does the farmer actually get from this experience, and how does he incorporate that into how he farms, basically?
Well, perfect segue here, Donna. I just hosted soil judging contest in Northwest Iowa for our region. So schools from the area, both 2 and 4 years, came to Northwest Iowa, hosted out of Lakeside Lab and the Northwest Iowa Research Farm and a few personal farms out of the area.
Mm-hmm.
Two of those farmers were former collegiate soil judges.
So you're really training the future farmers there, aren't you?
So in this particular case, they found it really fascinating or really interesting that they were able to do this, and they were observing different things when they went to their farm. They could see properties and see things that they wouldn't have necessarily known otherwise. However, the story of one of the collegiate contest pits is that we were looking for areas that would be interesting to include in this contest. There's always challenges in those contest pits, right? And I was working with my brother, who happens to be a farmer in Northwest Iowa, and had some land and agreed to host the contest part of this. And we were looking at different locations for pits, and he's like, you know, there's a spot that it just doesn't yield like it should, and I just don't know why. So maybe we should put a pit there and figure out why. And we started digging a pit, and at about 2.5 feet, the lust, the really silty, rich material that we found on the surface disappeared, and we had glacial outwash. So we had rocks and sand and gravel taking up 50% or 60% of the layer. So in a drought year like this one, it was particularly obvious because that plant didn't have access to the water that the plant on the next hill did because it had rocks underneath it.
So that means the rocks don't hold the moisture, right?
Right. So sands, clay, or sand.
Oh, percolates really right through it then.
Yep. Yeah. So there's benefits of each of the textures. Sands mean that it can drain and there's spaces for air to move in. Silts and clays are finer particles. Clays, think of like sheets in a book.
Mm-hmm.
They can stick together. You could have, if you get a book wet, how long is that going to be wet? A really long time. So the clays really hold on to water. Lusts or silt, those silty textures that we find on the top are great because they're generally pretty fertile, hold a lot of plant available water. And so the top 2 feet or 3 feet of that profile was great for that plant. But in a year that was dry, particularly in Northwest Iowa, the plant really needed more water than could be held by those rocks. So if the soil had been all of that silty clay, silt material, then it would have looked better. It would have had more of yield than this one did. And that's something you had to look under the surface to figure out, what's going on here?
Was the rock layer then when you dug the hole?
It was at about 2.5 feet.
And then went down how far?
Oh, it went about 2.5 feet.
More?
It went another 2.5 feet.
Uh-huh.
So it went down to about 5 feet. And then there was some sands and some glacial sorted materials underneath it.
So what's Nathan going to do with that ground now that he has this information next year?
Well, first of all, he just knows why, which was part of the deal. He'd like to know why that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know that this area isn't going to yield, you may adjust your fertilizer rates. You may decide to take that particular area out of row crop production and put it in something else, put it in maybe a CRP program because your return is not going to be optimal there. It's not going to be as high. Particularly if you anticipate a drought period coming over in the next years, you may have better options or better strategies to deal with that ground. Or you may just say, okay, this area is just going to have lower yield in a dry year.
So who has to dig the hole when you do these things?
It depends. The Northwest Iowa Research Farm was nice enough to dig their own pits, as was Jacob Schultz. Jacob and Ty Schultz in Northwest Iowa were the host for another site. And Nathan, Dad started digging the pits, and Nathan, as the former soil judger, decided what they actually needed to look like and adjusted them accordingly.
So the students don't have to come out and dig their own holes then?
No, students do not. But wouldn't that add to the complexity?
Yes, use all that young energy for hole digging. Well, So the question I want to ask today is, I've been particularly puzzled about this, and I'm just trying to understand what is going on. So Iowa has a what we call a voluntary nutrient reduction strategy, and this came about, and the necessity for it came about, and we've talked about this on the show before, is when there is too much nitrogen applied, more than can be utilized by the crops and held in the soil, it goes into the water system. Now, everybody in Iowa is aware that Des Moines has so much nitrogen nutrient, too much stuff in their water that is unsafe for human drinking, and they have to remove it at the, you know, in the city water plant. We also all know that Iowa is the largest contributor of nitrates that causes the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So it goes into the Missouri, into the Mississippi, down the river, and forms unfortunate things down there for everybody. And also, our own rivers and lakes are having more algal blooms, are less safe to swim in. It is a big issue. So unlike other states, for example, Minnesota, I have been told, has a ban on applying nitrates in the fall. You're not allowed to do it after the crop has been harvested. Now, we don't do any of that in Iowa. So I was thinking, okay, Amber, the price of nitrogen has gone up how much?
2 or 3 times in the last couple of years.
Right. It's become very expensive. And some of this is because of the war in Ukraine, because a lot of fertilizers are made from natural gas. Is that where it comes from? Something petroleum-based. What is it, Amber?
The Haber-Bosch process is the process that was developed to basically take a really stable N2 atmospheric and get it into a plant-usable form. So it takes a ridiculous amount of energy to do that. Naturally, like a lightning strike would add a little bit. That's the sort of energy we're talking about. We're talking about a lot of energy. But this was developed, Haber-Bosch, for wartime efforts, but we realized
World War
that
II.
Nitrogen...
Yeah.
So we use this process for making nitrogen so we can put it on the soil. Why do we add nitrogen to soil?
Ooh, so nitrogen is a really important plant nutrient. It's involved in photosynthesis for the plant, and as we know, that plants are photosynthesizing in green and need that nitrogen. Nitrogen's really important to a plant's function. So it's important that we have plenty of nitrogen available to make sure that the plant can capture energy and use it to grow.
So with the cost of fossil fuels going up, that put up the cost significantly of all of the nitrogen fertilizer that's used not only in Iowa but all over the world. And so I was thinking, well, if the price is going up and I were a farmer, you know, I would be considering where could I reduce my nitrogen input costs, right? And I know there have been a lot of studies done in Iowa. Both you mentioned this, PFI has done some nitrogen reduction studies, and of course ISU has done a lot. So what do we know about this project?
So the complication in nitrogen is that, one, it is not in a stable form. It doesn't just sit on the soil. It's biologically active. And even more importantly, the nitrate that you're talking about getting in water mm-hmm. is negatively charged, as opposed to an NH4 nitrogen ammonium, which is positively charged and wouldn't leach through the soil. So the important thing is the chemistry and the interaction with the charges in the soil. This is why we don't have problems with, like, potassium leaching. We don't hear about that mm-hmm. as a thing. Because of our soils interact with nutrients differently. So nitrate is negatively charged, so is the soil particles, and nitrate then is not magnetized, it's actually repelled from the soil surface. So we find it in solution, which is great for a plant who wants to take that up. But if we get rainfall when there's a lot of nitrate in the soil, we have the potential to have that go with the water, which was lost to the plant, at least. It could end up in some sort of a water body. It could end up in the wetland, and the wetland would, the anaerobic decomposition would tend to use that as a electron acceptor and therefore have it denitrify and go off into the atmosphere. So then if it goes through a wetland, it's not considered a drinking water problem, as opposed to water that would end up, that would go relatively quickly through a system and end up in drinking water a short period after, or a short time after it's been raining.
Okay, so it goes quickly through the system where there's tiling. Is that the issue?
That's one of the factors that would influence the speed at which, yep. Because now there's a conduit out of the soil. Instead of having, it has to work around all of those soil particles, and it now has a quicker way out, which is really beneficial if we'd like plant roots there, because plant roots don't grow underwater. They need some water, but they don't want to be saturated. So we've modified the system to make it work for our crops that we're growing, and there are consequences of any change in your system.
Okay, so when, like you mentioned to me, that your brother Nathan has found that he can reduce his nitrogen applications by 30%. Okay, in my mind that goes, okay, 30% savings in the cost of the crop production. That sounds significant. Plus, I would think if all of the farmers in Iowa reduce their nitrogen applications by 30%, that might benefit the local water quality. So how does Nathan do this? Where does that research come from?
So he's taking part in a PFI study, but there are other studies as mm-hmm. well. He personally reduced his rate from over 0.8, 0.9, something like that, to 0.65 pounds of nitrogen per bushel. So on a 200 bushel corn crop, that's about 30 pounds decrease of nitrogen. In the rate trial, they showed a minimal couple bushel response to an additional 45 pounds of nitrogen, but conditions are not always exactly the same. So if we have drought conditions, the plant is likely limited by other factors mm-hmm. rather than nitrogen. If we had a perfect year, then the additional nitrogen could directly translate into additional yield. However, we have a really hard time because we can't predict exactly what the yield is going to be. We can't predict what the conditions are going to be. And so there's some measure of insurance or making sure that we have enough if we have conditions to make sure that we can get a crop.
So how does Nathan know, for example, that it's okay to reduce by 30% without a yield drag?
Because he's tried it. And this is an important thing. If you're trying a practice, you don't want to just do the whole thing.
You don't bet the whole farm, right?
Right. You don't know if it's that. Well, and you don't know if it's something that year that did mm-hmm. it or something else that you did differently. You can't separate out those variables unless you do a partial, don't try all of it at once. Try part of it. Try a strip of something. Try different treatments to see and be able to separate out those factors. Was it the year? Did I just happen to do this right? Was it actually nitrogen rate? Was it something else?
So, for example, in organic systems, and we have some good farmers in Iowa that use organic systems, you do not apply the anhydrous ammonia kinds of nitrates at all. You have to use other soil amendments like animal manure or, I don't know, maybe seaweed or something else besides the things that come from petroleum products. Now, and obviously, these farmers are doing just fine. So what prevents more farmers in Iowa from reducing the petrochemical inputs?
Great. So organic farmers are relying on biological forms. So that could be the manures, but it also could be an alfalfa crop. It could be legumes. And that's what we had historically done in Iowa before the Haber-Bosch process, was we could have legumes, clover, alfalfa. Alfalfa is a
soybeans.
Common one.
Yeah.
Soybeans, but they were not around the state at that point in time. They weren't introduced till later, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a variety of sources of nitrogen, and nitrogen's all around us. Nitrogen gas is really abundant. However, getting it into a usable form is biologically expensive. So we either have to put energy in, or that soybean plant needs to invest in the location, in the relationship between the rhizobium and between the fixing organism, rhizobium and bradyrhizobium for soybeans and alfalfa. And they basically make a house for it. And so they invest energy, they feed the organism and get the nitrogen.
And also, what about, and this is a very big Iowa thing, what about all the manure that's coming off of the CAFOs? Doesn't that have nitrogen in it?
Oh, definitely. So all of those forms contribute to the nitrogen. The challenge in manures is you may be over applying phosphorus per unit nitrogen. So those green lakes aren't necessarily coming from nitrogen. Some of them are coming from phosphorus enrichment.
Oh.
And the phosphorus is mostly moved through erosion, so sediment moving into those water bodies. So if you are applying manure for all of it and wanting to meet your nitrogen need, you may be over-applying phosphorus. So the ratio in the manure isn't exactly what the plant needs. So it's not uncommon for manure to be part of your nutrients and then side dress or add additional supplemental nitrogen for a corn crop just to make sure that, or to get the ratio correct or reasonable for that, and not be over-applying phosphorus, which has its own set of problems.
So phosphorus is, wait, so NKP, right, is nitrogen.
NPK, yep.
What's
phosphorus? And potassium.
Okay. So you need some phosphorus, but you need it in a specific ratio?
So the removal rate of the corn, taking nitrogen versus phosphorus, is not the same as the ratio in manures. So if we, and actually this is fairly common in Iowa, if we have areas with histories of a lot of manure use, we have high phosphorus levels. So we don't necessarily want to environmentally increase or keep applying a lot of manure, because that isn't going to be helpful. If we have the erosion off of that ground, that's a lot of phosphorus that gets into the water body and can be a eutrophication sort of environment. So too much nutrient, too much phosphorus.
Okay, eutrophication is when it turns green. It's an algal bloom? Is that?
Yeah.
That's what happens.
So nutrient enrichment in water. Yeah.
Okay.
So in water, phosphorus is a really limiting factor.
Oh, okay. So you're teaching younger farmers all of this chemistry, because it's a lot to manage, right?
Well, it is a lot to manage. There's biological systems. There's different mechanisms for loss. We're managing a complex system. This is an environment. This is an ecological system that we are working within, or hopefully working within, to have crop production.
Well, okay, this is an educational question, but I've often wondered, when you get these young students, most of them are undergraduates, and most of them have come from farming families, right? And will go back to farming families. So how much are they learning from you? How much knowledge do they come in with? What is the point of not just learning from their father? What happens here?
Based upon the demographics of Iowa farms, we have a decrease in number of farm students that are coming into at least our program, because there just aren't that many young people in farming right now or being raised on farms. A couple generations ago, it was really common, but we have changing demographics in the state that affect a lot of things. So it's no longer an assumption that they're coming in with that agricultural knowledge and going back to that farm.
We're talking about what goes into our soil to make Iowa such a productive place to grow things. We're talking to Amber Anderson. This is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is Adonal in the Kitchen. We're talking about how we grow things, how the farmers in Iowa grow things. And, Amber, what happens if farmers don't put these nutrients back into the soil? I mean, haven't plants been growing out of the soil for years and millenniums and eons? How come there must be things added?
Great point. So if we went back 500 years on our landscape, that would look quite different. We would expect to find mostly prairie across the state. We would expect to find ruminants, particularly large ruminants moving across this landscape. But those ruminants would not be harvesting the area and taking everything elsewhere, but instead eating and leaving their droppings as well in the same area. So instead of having that nutrient removal or nutrient harvest, we would have a cycle that would more or less take place on a similar part of the landscape. Additionally, we had those prairie grasses multiple species that were all living at different points a year or different niches, adapted to the local area, that would be growing, photosynthesizing, and then capturing nutrients, and then the biological activity breaking down those, and then the soils, again, really rich, fertile soils that would be supplying nutrients to that system as well.
So it sounds like instead of encouraging not exactly a closed system, but at least a more sustainable cycle that we had in the prairie, it's like we're putting things in and taking things out quite on a large scale. When we talk about harvesting, we're harvesting most of the stuff we put in. Is that how it goes?
Well, if we think about a corn plant, we harvest the ear. There's a fair amount of residue still left, and that will go back there and be decomposed and be the nutrients, which is why we don't have to add a ton of material. But in the critical nutrients, or the ones that are potentially lost in the off-season when we don't have a crop growing there, which is an important factor, the biologically active nitrogen, if we have something growing there all year round, it's far less likely to be lost. Prairies have really negligible nitrogen losses because of this factor. But our corn crop is alive and taking up a lot of material from, say, May through August, September, and not really active the rest of the year. But we still get biological activity because the soils are still warm enough for the microbes to be working, and we still get rainfall in the rest of the year. So this biologically active molecule is kind of susceptible in our system.
Well, that brings us to cover crops.
Yes, and mm-hmm. naked fields, naked. Now, mm-hmm. even if you're not a farmer, or even if you don't garden or anything, I'm sure you drive around Iowa every now and then. Notice how those tall harvests of corn, they were green all summer, then they turn quite brown, and you go by a place and it's all cut off, and then it looks kind of bare. And in some cases, all that stuff is even plowed under, which means there's a lot of bare dirt.
So that's where you put the cover crop, right?
Yeah, the idea is don't farm naked, to have your soil covered. And the reason for this is to avoid the erosion and help with nutrient cycles. But in the winter, we have winds, we have all that material exposed, we have rains, the raindrop impact can splash that, we can get material moving off, eroding from water, we can get material eroding off from wind, and the stuff that we lose tends to be the most fertile stuff, because it's the material on the surface where we had plant growth and where we have that residue, we have those microbes, so we are losing the best stuff when we lose some soil due to erosion.
So what do you think is informing farmers' choices of applying cover crops? Or, I mean, this is kind of fairly new, right? To plant a crop that you're not going to harvest necessarily.
We've been using forage crops or a variety of different crops in our system historically for a variety of different purposes. Maybe we planted something after, or we had longer rotations to take advantage of more of the season's solar resources and to keep that covered longer. Not necessarily because we were really aware of erosion in the past, but we wanted to capture that solar energy and made sure we have enough forage for animals or livestock, et cetera. So cover crops are now to the point where they're a very common thing in a variety of different federal programs. In fact, you can even get a bit of a as of last year, you could get a rebate on your crop insurance if you had them. So there is some recognition that they're helpful. However, the barriers for adoption or the barriers for the farmer would be, one, the cost of the seed and then getting that in the ground. Some one option would be to fly it on. That can add up. Another option is a highboy sprayer or a highboy equipment that sits above the corn and drops the seed down. And then the other one would be to wait until after the crop is harvested, as opposed to the earlier where hopefully the crop or the cover crop gets started and starts growing so that when you take your corn off or take your crop off, you have a full green mat already there. Another option is after the crop comes off to come in and plant or drill or spread your seed and hope that you get rainfall to establish this. This year, this was a little bit of a challenge because of dry conditions. We need, just like in your garden or if you're trying to grow a lawn, you need moisture reliably to sprout. So certain cover crops are more tolerant to weather, to drought or to cold temperatures. And so different crops might be appropriate for different points in time. Then the other challenge comes from the farmer getting it killed in the spring so that you can plant your other crop and not have a detrimental effect on it. It's much more common to do cover crops going into soybeans, as soybeans are much more forgiving of early season competition than corn is. So having a cover crop, and again, we know what our springs look like. We could have really perfect conditions, but the likelihood is we'll have a rainy day and a sunny day and maybe even a day of snow in there. Who knows? So the timing is a challenge because the farmer needs to make sure that they have their crop, get it in the ground, and can have that cover crop controlled and also get any nutrients that are needed on to the crop. So it's kind of a timing issue, at least for part of it. If there's livestock, it's a much easier sell, I guess, because those farmers would have the additional benefit of a forage as a backup material in case they don't have quite as much pasture or don't have quite as much alfalfa so that they avoid buying additional forage from elsewhere.
It seems like in this part of the country, and maybe probably all across the United States, farmers plan on tilling up, planting everything. There used to be a concept of fallow, letting things rest, like having a field just grown up in hay or prairie or whatever. It must come down to the bottom line. It's like nobody wants to rest anything. We just have to keep planting and harvesting. Does anybody even use that term fallow anymore?
In the western part of the U.S. or in, say, Kansas, they might fallow for a season to hold up enough moisture to be able to grow a crop. Mm-hmm. But in Iowa, we usually had forages for livestock, and those livestock are not in the same sort of systems that they used to be.
Yeah, they're not in the fields anymore.
Right, they're not in the fields. They're not. It's not every family, every farm family has a few cows, a couple dairy cattle, and some hogs. That's no longer the case. So it's been a specialization in agriculture, and the people on a farm look very different than they did 100 years ago. The average age of a farmer is something like 60 years old. The acres farmed in Iowa on a row crop farm are generally much larger. However, we have some small farms as well, so it's a bifurcated sort of thing where there's a chunk of small farms and there's a chunk of big farms, and there's not a whole lot in between what used to be considered a family farm size range.
Okay, so One more practice we haven't talked about is no-till. Can you explain what it is and why people might adopt it or not?
Absolutely. So no-till is a practice of, instead of 100 years ago or 50 years ago when moldboard plowing, really aggressive turning over of the residue to incorporate it, put it in contact with the soil, have a dark soil surface so that it warmed up really, really quickly in the spring because that dark surface gathers more heat than, say, corn residue does. It's much more common, particularly in the hilly parts of the state, to have no-till practices where you're decreasing that disturbance and decreasing erosion, therefore, because we're not disturbing that soil. Those are going to be far more common, again, in the more rolling parts of the state rather than in the central part of the state. But the reasons for adoption are that we aren't necessarily losing the soil due to erosion as we might in a full moldboard plow in a more aggressive tilled system. And we also have technologies that allow us to deal with some of the complications of a no-till system. So we have planters with a down pressure that can make sure to get the seed into a good environment in spite of there being residue on the surface, in spite of it being a more challenging historically environment. So we can still get
you drill it in? Is that the terminology?
A drill is usually a different sort of an implement, but this would be a setting on a planter. Oh. It would just be the amount of pressure that the planter has to put on instead of just opening a furrow and dropping it in.
Mm-hmm.
We have a certain amount of energy that goes in to make sure that the seed is put at the right level, at the right depth in the soil.
So it takes special equipment to do no-till. And some of the advantages of no-till are that it holds the soil moisture better. Is that true?
Yeah, we would expect that when we turn over a soil that's exposed to the air, instead of having the dry layer on the surface, now we lost additional moisture. And we also have chemicals that allow us to not control weeds through tillage like we used to, but we have other chemical methods of weed control that allow us to spray and not disturb the soil surface as opposed to, again, previous generations that didn't have the same technology.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about, I saw in the latest PFI newsletter, they had a, what are the things that, the seed treatments that seem to be causing the loss of bees?
Nicotinoids.
Yep. Right, okay. So they had a couple of farmers do some trials on using untreated seeds versus using treated seeds. And according to what I read, there didn't seem to be any yield loss whether or not they were using the treated seeds. Now, this kind of goes against the sales pitches for using treated seeds. Now, the problems with using treated seeds is that the seed treatment, which is basically an insecticide because it's meant to kill the bugs that are going to eat the seeds in the baby plants, right? This insecticide is in the treated seed, and it stays in the plant so that if the, I don't know, whatever, the worm or whatever starts to eat it, it dies. And that all sounds just dandy, but the problem is that
neonicotinoid.
Neonicotinoid, yes. Just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? It does not stay in the field. It also goes into the water and has now been determined that this is a large cause of, we're killing all the good insects too at the same time. So I was very interested to see in the PFI study that, and I had read this elsewhere, that maybe these chemical treatments are not necessary. I mean, where does a farmer get information other than from the company that's selling the product?
It depends on your farmer. Some of them have great networks, and some of them are going to do what they have historically done, just like any of us. Where do we get knowledge? Mm-hmm. Where do we get information? How do we make decisions? So, yeah, just like any farmer, or just like any of us, what sort of risks are you willing to take? And then from a company perspective, it's also a bit of an insurance. In case you have a problem with that, your seed is still a viable seed. I think that a conversation about risk management or how we might approach more targeted use of things that are likely having limited effectiveness, be that chemicals or even nutrients or mm-hmm. something. Like, how do we better match what's actually needed to that area? We have technologies that are allowing more and more of that, but now we need to figure out how to incorporate that into our system more so that we are making best use of our resources and having least amount of unintended consequences. Yep.
Yeah, true, true. I want to take a little bit of break here and mention this is KHOI Community Radio. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Amber Anderson about
soil science.
Soil and stuff that goes into it. And Amber, you were talking about how people make decisions, how farmers make decisions, and we are all susceptible to the people that are selling us things and the big companies that make additives and pesticides and fertilizers and whatever. They sell things, and the trouble is we listen. I mean, remember, we all believed that we would get bouncing and behaving hair by if we just bought the right kind of shampoo. And we do that. We do that. And it didn't work, Donna. But you know how it works. We're responsible for ourselves, but we also respond to our environment around us. And there are some big players that let's call it loud voices that are selling things to the American farmer.
Well, one thing that's coming up is it next week? Yes, November 6th, the COP27 is happening in the climate conference is happening in Egypt this year, and it's been widely announced that they're going to have an agricultural pavilion. Woohoo! Okay, yes, we are now admitting that agriculture is a large contributor to greenhouse gases and climate change. And of course, the negative impacts is, you know, as the weather changes, like this year in Iowa and Kansas, they just announced that the wheat, you know, the wheat crop is really poor this year because of that, the drought that Western Iowa is facing has also been really predominant in Kansas. And, you know, the questions of how are we going to feed ourselves as climate changes and where the moisture is too much, where the moisture is too little. These are big, big, big issues that frankly nobody has the answers to yet. We just know it's a problem, by golly. What are we going to do? So the thing is, at the upcoming COP27, when the agriculture shows up, it's going to be the guys with the money. They're going to show up and build the pavilion and make the show and, you know, because they can afford to. It's advertising, basically. So my question has just been, you know, how, as a farmer, as any consumer, but a farmer is a consumer of agricultural inputs, making these decisions is really must be getting more and more complicated. And Amber, you're training all of these future farmers. So what kinds of things are they asking? What are you teaching them? How are you helping them to be prepared to deal with these really, really big questions?
That's an excellent question. My hope is I'm giving them the tools, because a whole bunch of tools could be applied in different ways mm-hmm. depending upon the circumstances. If I'm just telling them what's done today, that doesn't do them a service at all. That does them a disservice, because agriculture is not likely to look exactly like it does. Do I know exactly what that's going to look like? Absolutely not. I don't think anyone does. However, these basic principles still apply. So if they understand the basics of how water moves through soil, the basics of the nitrogen and nutrients and plant physiology, it doesn't matter if they're growing corn. It doesn't matter if they're growing in a horticultural context in a greenhouse. It's the same basic principles that apply. So I guess I'm somewhat hopeful because there's some really creative and really passionate students that I work with on a regular basis that have ideas, and they're not necessarily what we've done in the past, but I think those ideas and those thoughts and those that inspiration to be able to try something different is what is needed and what's going to be needed in the face of changing conditions in the future. So I guess I'm hopeful because I work with a lot of really talented, creative students who come up with things that I wouldn't have necessarily thought come up with at all, because they're really passionate about this and wanting to learn. And I'm sure they will do great things, put those pieces together in very different ways than I would have imagined. So
well,
I guess I am hopeful.
Take this right to your own family, because Amber grew up in a farming family, and Amber's brother Nathan is farming with your father, right? So, and I'm sure that you, even you, because you're not farming, but you're still in the business, so to speak, what kind of dialogues do you guys have amongst yourselves, coming with your father's generation and what Nathan wants to do and what your educational background? How do you guys negotiate all this?
Well, I have to give my dad a lot of credit. He has transitioned the decision-making to Nathan over time, to the point where when Nathan first started on the farm, Dad was the decision maker and Nathan was the labor. And at this point, we're transitioned to the point that Nathan is making decisions and Dad is the labor now. So that takes a lot of willingness to give up control. And I have to give him a lot of credit to be able to have that foresight to realize, okay, in order to be comfortable and to try things, to be comfortable managing, you're going to need to try different things. Those are going to look different than they did in my generation, and to slowly give up that control in a planned way so it's not catastrophic, or like 1 year you're making no decisions and the next year you're making all the decisions, I think made for a more stable situation. There are always going to be interesting conversations, call it, because of the I guess farm families are interesting because you have both of the farm aspect, the business aspect of it, and the family aspect. And we can see how having both of those alone would be plenty to deal with. But now we're intermingling them, which makes for even more complicated relationships or interactions. So a lot of planning is needed for successful, a lot of planning and communication is needed for a successful operation, I think.
Well, and with your background and as the girl in the family, where do you chime in?
Oh, this is great. I love that I can have really interesting conversations. I can make sure that what I am having in class, or I can stay grounded and make sure that my understanding matches what's actually being practiced today on the farm. I can make sure that that anything that's a challenge, or a variety of things that are a challenge, I can consider how I approach those and when I'm teaching. But also, I can have really interesting conversations when Nathan asks, oh, what do you think about this? Oh, I'm considering this change. Oh, have you heard about this thing?
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk through the mechanisms of how that might work, and if that's a reasonable thing, or if it's just a sales pitch that is overblowing, or it's just hype, and we can at least talk through the biological mechanisms or how that would be reasonable, and then how it might fit in his operation so that it's because what works in one area might not work in another. And then we have interesting conversations about quality of life, because a farmer also would like to have a reasonable quality of life, and obviously has to make money to stay on the farm. So while our environmental impact or our environmental piece may be at the top, we need to be balancing that with a farmer's quality of life and the fact that they have to live in this community. So there's social aspects that are sometimes ignored in the why aren't all the farmers doing this? Because it's the first person in an area to try something is the weird farmer. So there's social aspects of just like you, and the first person to try this this thing or the last person to try something. There's social aspects that you might think of when you decide, hey, you're going to use this technology or not. A farmer has, except they have the community aspect, and then they have the business aspect of it as well. So there's a few levels of complication that we don't necessarily think about or have to deal with as someone who maybe has those pieces of their life separate.
Well, it also sounds like in your family farm, you guys really work to stay very information rich. So you're making more informed decisions. So that's a lot of work. And it's lovely to talk to you because I know you're really passionate about your own family farm and about agronomy. So thank you very much, Amber.
Thank you for being with us today. Good. Talk to Amber Anderson from the ISU Agronomy Department. We've been talking about soils and farming and nutrients and all that.
Fertilizer.
Kind of stuff. Fertilizer. Yes,
yeah.
Very good.
It's a very fertile conversation here.
Very good. We have some upcoming things. We heard a lecture by a person named Tom Philpott.
Right. It was. He wrote a book called Perilous Bounty. He is a Mother Jones correspondent. And we're going to air that that conversation, which happened at the library last week. It was sponsored by, what's ICCI? Iowa Citizens for Community something or other. Great organization that I just call ICCI. Anyway, they brought Tom Philpott in to talk about the agronomy issues in Iowa and in California, the sort of two major very productive agricultural issues areas in the country. So that will be replayed Saturday at noon on KHOI if you want to hear Tom Philpott talk about Perilous Bounty. Lana and I both went to hear him at the library. It was very interesting.
A good thing to listen to. Yes, it was. And there's also going to be tomorrow, Wednesday, 6 o'clock at Stevens Auditorium, a lecture on the 1619 Project. It's a lecture, so go and see what you can learn.
That's an interesting one. I did not realize, of course, it's now become very controversial in political circles about whether we teach about the history of slavery or not, but the woman giving the lecture who started this project is from Iowa.
So it's good.
There you go.
Tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, Wednesday. There we go. So you've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. You can hear us at noon, every noon on Tuesday, 7 p.m. on Tuesday, or you can stream and go to the archives at the KHOI website. Support this fine radio station. We had music by the Barn Owl Band today. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering. Excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Watch the field behind the plow, turn to straight, dark roads, feel the trickle in your clothes, blow the dust cake from your nose, and hear the tractor's steady roar. Oh, you can't stop now, there's a quarter section more or less to go, and it figures that the rain keeps its own sweet time. You can watch it come for miles, but you guess you've got a while, so ease the throttle out of air. Every rod's a gain, and there's victory in every quarter mile. Poor old Kuzik down the road, heartache, hail, and hoppers brought him down. Gave it up and went to town. And Emmett Pierce the other day took a heart attack, died at 42. Well, you could see it coming on, 'cause he worked as hard. In an hour, maybe more, you'll be wet clear through. The air is cooler now. Pull your hat brim farther down and watch the field behind the plow.
turned a straight dark rose, put another season's promise in the ground.